The following is a presentation of the Sovereign Tech Double Secret Exclusive Feed.
This Patreon-only broadcast originally aired on August 10th, 2023, and is now available to the public. Enjoy a taste of Q&A.
Ooh, the Man of Tomorrow is here for your Wednesday Q&A, and hot damn. We have got a lot to get into, as we always do. The question bank has been filling up, and we've got some subjects that I really, really want to get into. So I've kind of offset some questions that that I had gotten in, just to make sure that we can fit these in. I mean, there's a lot. I am going to the Discord channel. We're going to pull exclusively from the Discord channel. Not that you can't still email q22@nwo.red. I have the new email address also created, but I won't announce that just yet. We got some big stuff going on. Get your questions in there, and I'll certainly get them in, via email as well. Usually it's a great place to get in longer stuff, even though clearly listeners are doing just fine getting in longer questions on Discord as well. And I will get into those. Let me see here. There was one that Jacob, oh yeah. Okay. So Jacob shared an episode of Rune Soup in the Discord. There's a sub channel for patrons. There's a sub channel that's podcast episodes I'm listening to. And it's where you can share interesting podcasts that you happen to hear. It's funny. I listen to podcasts pretty much every day, and I really should be sharing all of them in there, but for whatever reason, I don't. Anyway, Jacob brought it up. I'll get into this, and then I think we're going to get to a sequel question to the last Q&A that has to do with things existing outside the universe, or outside of universe. I'll talk about that. Why didn't I say the? I'll get into that. And then we're going to get into, a classic work known as Sun and Steel. It's good. Anyway, it's going to be a great conversation, I think. So, this is an episode of Rune Soup, which is a podcast that I enjoy by Gordon White, who also wrote a great text called the Chaos Protocols. It's about chaos magic. It's also incredibly libertarian, almost anarchistic. He said, this was on August 1st, 2023. Jacob said, heard this and thought of you immediately, Lord Sovereign. Don't know how many times I've heard you say something very similar. So the name of the episode, it's a very recent episode. It's from July 28th of this year. And it's, Are There Aliens in the Bible? Now, I'm not going to go into a deep dive on this. I did listen to the episode that Jacob shared. I am reading the book that they talk about in that episode. And the book is called Gods of the Bible. It's by Miro Beglino, which, if that sounds Italian, that's because this is somebody who actually works for the Vatican, who is a hardcore Catholic and has essentially come to the conclusion that much of what's being discussed within the Old Testament, particularly, is aliens. It's UFOs and aliens. And again, this is coming from, a full-on, I think he's a Catholic priest. Anyway, I'm not finished with the book. Unfortunately, there's no audiobook. Otherwise, I would be finished with the book already because I'd listen to it in a day. But I am reading through it the old-fashioned way, and I'll certainly be doing a review of it. The great thing is that Gordon White and the guest that he has on this episode of Rune Soup, Reverend Danny Nouveau, they pick apart a lot of what's being said in Gods of the Bible. And they're basically saying, okay, it's so funny. And I think this is part of what Jacob was referencing as far as me having said this all, like he said, I thought of you immediately. Don't know how many times I've heard you say something very similar. Yeah. Okay. So Gordon White's problem with the ancient alien hypothesis is once you get to spaceships, once you start talking about spaceships, he's like, no, you've lost me. Like, no, it's not spaceships. And I agree. Like I'm with you, even though, it could be airships, or I think Gordon White might even be more particular in saying spaceships from like another solar system or something. I mean, that's where I run into problems. Okay. You know, because I'm all about like the spaceships of Ezekiel, you know, Joseph Blumrich's work. I'm totally on board, you know, with a lot of what he laid out, that it could have been like ancient airships or something along those lines from an advanced civilization at the time, or that it existed previous to recorded history. One of the things I'm not going to go crazy with, I just want to say that I was really blown away by the conversation, and I really enjoyed the conversation. I wasn't blown away because, like Jacob said, a lot of it's stuff I've been espousing for, you know, the past 10 years anyway. But I do recommend, if I think of it, I'll link to it in the show notes. I do recommend people give it a listen. It's a fascinating conversation. One of the best parts of it for me, there are my two favorite parts of this. One was the level of respect given to Zachariah Sitchin by both of the hosts. You know, basically saying like, no, you don't get it. He really was a genius. Like, okay, yeah, they might not have come from the planet Abiro and all this other stuff, but he was onto something, and the discrediting by the academic community of him was completely undeserved, unwarranted, and downright wrong, like incorrect. It was, you know, it was not factual. And I just loved getting to hear someone else who also doesn't believe in the idea of spaceships, you know, from another, you know, coming from outside the solar system, which Nibiru still would, even though it's technically a part of the solar system in a way, just circles in every 3,500 years. But to hear someone else give Sitchin the credit that he richly deserves was beautiful on its own. The other thing that I really enjoyed, I mean, there's so much in this that was really solid. The other thing that I enjoyed was Gordon White's discussion about how language is psychedelic. And it is. There's an order in which I plan to get into questions in this episode, and because they all kind of flow off of each other, interestingly. And some other things flowed together, interestingly, which I'll talk about. But anyway, but they talk about how language is psychedelic, basically meaning, in fact, Gordon White's, the guest that he had on, Danny, right? He made the beautiful, beautiful point that Torah, particularly Torah, more so than the Tanakh, because when you get into the Tanakh, some things are in Aramaic, something, you know, and what got included from Greek and what didn't. Well, anyway, that's getting into Septuagint. That's a separate conversation. But, you know, what's from the Targums? What is all this? Anyway, in Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, okay? You can actually, biblical Hebrew, this is the point that Danny made, biblical Hebrew is incredibly easy to learn. And he's not wrong. It is. Okay. Now, there's expansion upon Hebrew, and Aramaic is a completely different animal, even though it uses the same alphabet. But learning how to read the Torah, raw dog, in the original language is not hard. Why? Because it actually doesn't have a large vocabulary. It uses a lot of the same exact words to mean very different things. One of the examples that they bring up is an example that I often bring up, and it's an important word. The word is ruach. Okay, ruach is, in one sense, is in a its most base level, ruach means wind. But ruach can actually mean a lot more. Ruach, and Gods of the Bible gets into this too, ruach could actually mean something flying, meaning it could be an airplane, okay? Or it could be a person flying, or it could be, it could be a spaceship, I guess. Maybe that would be Gods of the Bible's, you know, that book's argument. But it also, ruach is also similar to the Polynesian concept of mana, in that it's this force that's out there that you know, it's a magic, it's an energy that's out there that you can feel and that you can even harness. Okay. So ruach can mean a lot of things. And this is Gordon White's great point, that language itself is psychedelic in the sense that it can be, you know, read in so many different ways. I'm being very basic in this, but it's something that's really key to grok. Okay. Because I'm not knocking anybody for doing psychedelics. I'm not ripping on anybody for doing psychedelics. I'm not saying anyone's wrong for doing psychedelics. It's not what I'm saying here. What I'm saying is that language itself is a psychedelic experience when it is the right language. If it's a language like Hebrew, Okay. And this gets in, I mean, and in my opinion, Hebrew absolutely is a psychedelic experience. For example, when you consider Abulafian meditation techniques that are meditating on Hebrew words. Now you can actually do it with other, you can actually do it with other languages. It doesn't just have to be Hebrew. Like the abstract concept of just like trying to spell, you know, like rearrange the words and or letters in so many different ways. How many words can you create? And then eventually getting beyond the words, which was the ultimate goal of Abulafian meditate of that particular Abraham Abulafia, you know, so Abulafian, that Abulafian Kabbalistic meditation technique. Getting beyond the words, we're going to talk more about that. But that's the thing, is that it itself is take, you know, that concentration on just the letters, on the language, on the words, is leads one to a what could only be called as a psychedelic experience. Or perhaps you want to go with ecstatic experience, and we'll get into that a little bit more here shortly as well. So language itself, letters, all that, and your concentration upon them and your usage of them itself is, I don't want to say a psychonautic practice. That word annoys the fuck out of me. But again, I'm not knocking anybody. I know lots of people that I respect highly who call themselves that or rock that. And okay, it's fine. It's fine. You're exploring things as you go, and it leads you to truths and all, you know, dynamite. Okay, so I'm not knocking it. But language itself can be a psychedelic experience. Can be an ecstatic experience. And so, and the reason I'm bringing this up is then, well, you know, do you need to take psychedelics? To some degree, maybe some people do. And that's a separate conversation for another time. Okay. And maybe, who knows, maybe everybody really would be better off if they did. Okay. You know, to me, it's inconsequential at this point, but regardless, we'll keep rocking. but language itself can do the job. Okay. And we'll get into more of why, but it's a beautiful point that he makes in that episode. And talking about how, if you don't understand the psychedelic nature of language, that's why you don't understand what much of the Torah is saying. Now, is this new? Did this realization just become a new thing by Danny Nemu and Gordon White? By no means. This is exactly what rabbis and Jewish mystics, Hebrew mystics and Kabbalists and whatever term you want to use, they knew this about their own text thousands of years ago, right? When the rabbis would say, it's like, look, if Torah was just a law book, well, we'd throw it away because it sucks. It sucks as a law book. You know, we can make a better one right now, but it's not a law. It's not, or at least it's not just a law book. It's more. It in of itself, even though they wouldn't know the term psychedelic, is a psychedelic experience. You know, it's funny. A lot of, you know, I've had people ask me even recently, like, is there value? You know, you're big on the Zohar. You know, you talk about Torah a lot and things happening in the Tanakh and whatever. And we got to be clear here. Okay. All right. Let me make some delineations. And we're going to get into all these questions. Okay. Let me make some delineations here. I've said this before, but if anybody's new, I need you to understand this. Okay. Because Judaism and the Jewish literary tradition is incredibly complex on its own. Unfortunately, part of that really just comes down to the fact that English speaking peoples and, you know, are lazy often enough because I mean, really, you still haven't gotten rid of the K in front of knife. Come on, guys. Did you ditch that already? Oh, talk about inefficiency. Anyway, or how about this? In fact, I was going to save this for later, but I'll get into it quick now. You want to, like, fuck English. And I'm going to start doing this too. You know, one of the things I love, my favorite Linux distro is, you know, we'll bring in a touch of tech here. My favorite Linux distro is Fedora. And do you know what they call Fedora for the everyday user? You know, like the desktop version of Fedora. Do you know what they call that? They call it Workstation. It's called Fedora Workstation. Now, they rebranded this a few years ago. I completely applauded in the community. There was a lot of argument about this in the community at the time. I completely applauded calling it Workstation. Why? Because you shouldn't call it, and again, you know, for simplicity's sake and for, you know, quote unquote, the masses, I would say, and then this is what we got to work on, is getting the masses to have more precision in their language. Okay. I would say desktop or desktop OS or desktop computer and whatever, because, you know, those terms have taken on more meaning even beyond the concept of the top of a desk. Okay. But workstation actually more accurately describes what it is. Like when I look at a computer screen that, and when I'm at a computer, okay, like that is a workstation. It should be a workstation OS, not a desktop OS. Like when we call Android and iOS, when we call them mobile OSs, that's beautiful. That's perfect. That accurately describes what they are. It is an OS designed for a mobile device to function in a touch fashion that you use on the go. Can it do more? Sure can. But at its base level, that's what it is. A desktop OS at its base level, when you're looking at the computer screen, that is not a desktop. The desktop is what the fucking monitor is on. That's the top of a desk. That's the desktop. You're looking at a workstation. Why? Because you're getting on there to do some fucking work. I mean, yeah, and you can play too, but you know, that's its own, its own little form of work. But anyway, you know, this precision of language is such an issue. So what I'm getting at here, okay, I want to make this abundantly clear that you have to understand. There is a difference in Judaism, okay, and I'm going to talk about what this means for the Talmud. Just one second. When we say Torah, now a popular phrase in recent decades has been to call it Talmud Torah, to effectively be able to express that the Jews follow more than the Old Testament, okay. There is more than the Old Testament. There is what's called Talmud Torah. So what is this? Okay, Torah really is just the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Okay, that's Torah. All the other books outside of that are the Tanakh. Okay? And when you get outside of Torah, when we talk about like this, that Torah is psychedelic, or that the language is a psychedelic experience and all this, that's really only referencing the first five books. Okay. What Moses got handed down, what is genuinely like really inspired shit of some thing, whether it's the Ayin Sof or whatever you happen to believe, that's Torah. The rest of the, what Christians call Old Testament, the other books, okay, you think like 1 Kings, 2 Kings, you know, the Psalms and some others. Well, the Psalms gets into maybe Proverbs, you know, Ecclesiastes, some of these other things. This is all the Tanakh, okay? And now the Torah is printed and part of the Tanakh, but the Tanakh itself is not the entirety, of the Tanakh, okay? When you get to the outside of Torah, when you get to the rest of the Tanakh, the rest of the Old Testament, its inspiration is of a, at the very least, lower quality. And this is true with, I mean, you know, I'm speaking as somebody who doesn't believe in God, but even those who do believe in Hashem and, you know, really observant, shall we say, I mean, I like to think I observe Judaism in its proper context, but really observant modern Orthodox Jews or Orthodox Jews, you know, they would say the same thing I'm saying to you, that yes, these are less inspired, still holy, but less inspired. Okay. Now, it being less inspired leads to where some of these books, and you know, Jews organize these things in that way. It's not like Christians where they do the Old Testament and they try to do it somewhat chronologically. It's Jews rather break things up by the early prophets, the later prophets, the writings, you know, so on. Okay. So you have books that are historical texts. They're not holy texts. They're historical texts. For example, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, perhaps Ezra and Nehemiah, you know, like a lot of these different books. Then you do have books that would be considered prophetic, not in that they tell the future, but that in that they tell the present. I would argue some books, and I've, you know, written about this and I've talked about this in podcasts. Some books within the Tanakh are actually battle scrolls. Coded battle scrolls for the Maccabean revolt. And you like the Book of Daniel and some others, you know, a lot of this shit is, it's not even referencing anything. It's all like coded battle plans. I've talked about this a little bit. You can actually go to my Medium page, which we're going to talk about that more in a minute. Just type in nwo.red. That takes you to my link tree. Okay. I've made it really fucking simple. You know, you have to type in 6 letters and a period. Okay. nwo.red. It's short as it can get, just about. And that'll get you to my Medium page. And you can read where, even recent, just in this past week, I've re-released pieces that I wrote for the spirituality section that talk about how, particularly with, there's one about Hanukkah. In fact, I think it's titled You Don't Know Hanukkah, where I talk about how, you know, a lot of, or parts of the Tanakh are really just battle plans between Maccabean, which are, you know, Jews that were taking on the Seleucid Empire at the time, the Greeks and Hellenized Jews, we'll say, Greek influenced Jews, where they were just tossing battle plans between each other, you know, and anyway, it all gets very complex. Okay. Other parts of the Tanakh, there are parts of the Tanakh that I do think are what we would consider sacred texts, where they are actually like, they are Kabbalistic texts and they are teaching you something to do with the mystical. For example, the Song of Songs or the Book of Job. Those are two that I think, you know, and Psalms, the Book of Psalms itself is another one, that, which the Psalms is a collection of a bunch of poems. It's not like it's one book. Okay. So basically what you got to grok is that once you get outside of the first 5 books, okay, once you get outside of actual Torah, a lot of this stuff is up to interpretation and up for grabs and could have varying different uses. It becomes a very much a textual Wild West. Okay. Talmud. And the reason I bring this up, well, all right, hold on, let me back up. So you have the written Torah, which we talked about. Then you have what's called the oral Torah. Okay. And this will get important. Trust me. Then we have what's called the oral Torah. The oral Torah was the things, and there's, it's self-referenced in the Torah itself that there is something more. There is an oral Torah. The same thing happens in the New Testament, right? When you get into the book of 2 Timothy, where it says, pay attention to the, you know, basically the traditions of, you know, like of the apostles and so on. 2 Timothy is saying that there are rules that, or there's rules, there's divine inspiration that exists outside of the New Testament. And this is what the Catholic Church is ultimately based upon, right? Because they can say, well, no, we're the carrying on of the traditions. It's effectively their own oral Torah, but they, of course, they would write theirs down. Anyway, so you have the oral Torah, which nobody knew except for the priestly class would carry down for supposedly thousands of years. Jews or Egyptians. I'm not going to get into that conversation here. I've already said it too many times. But anyway, okay. So let's just stick with somewhat conventional concepts here. So the oral Torah gets handed down for thousands of years until the Jews start to sweat when it looks like the Romans are going to wipe them out. And they're like, well, we can't lose this shit. We've got to write this shit down, you know, but there might not be, like, they could kill every priest in Judea and we're fucked. We lose the oral Torah. Now, despite the fact that, like, really, would Hashem allow that to happen? You know, like that seeming lack of faith is a bit of a problem. But regardless, they do decide to write it down. And it's not actually a problem of a lack of faith, and I'll explain why in a second. But they write it down and they compile it into what's called the Mishnah. Okay. And the Mishnah, when you read it, it's not a book that you can read even like, you know, the books of the Tanakh. Okay. It's not something that just suddenly flows and makes a ton of sense. Okay. And there are actually other attempts. There's not just the Mishnah. There's also other attempts at writing down the oral Torah, like the Tosefta, which I would argue is just as important. Okay. So you have the Mishnah, you have this writing down of the oral Torah. The Talmud itself is a commentary ultimately on the Mishnah, but as commentary on the Mishnah, it also ends up being, and it is also, you know, at the end of the day, commentary on the written Torah. So it's commentary on written and oral Torah. Okay. I've mentioned this before. Most rabbis, like most students of Torah, actually don't read the Torah. They study Talmud, and through Talmud, they expect to understand and learn Torah ultimately. Okay. And this is where we call it Talmud Torah. Now, let me give you a little bit of other history, because it's actually going to color the entire conversation for this episode, regardless of question. Okay. In the oral Torah, or in the written oral Torah, I know that sounds paradoxical, but that's okay. That's where truth is. Truth is in paradox. Not to say it's in the Mishnah. Okay. But in the Mishnah, there is a point where it expressly says that there are things you still can't write down. So, you know, like, where does this, and the reason I'm bringing this up is like, wait, where does the Zohar come from? And what is ultimately the point of Talmud? And that's what I want to answer for you here before we go further. Okay. So in Mishnah, it says there are some things that we still can't write down. And the three things they list off are sexual laws. So there's matters relative to sex that cannot be written down. This is important. Again, it's three things. Interesting that it's three. The other are aspects of the account of creation. Okay. So there's things that occurred during the quote unquote book of Genesis that are part of the oral Torah that could not even be written down in the Mishnah, even with the Roman armies bearing down and potentially, committing mass genocide. And the third thing is what would be translated into English as accounts of the chariot, accounts of the Merkabah. In accounts of the chariot, the Merkabah, that's how you say that in Hebrew. Merkabah is the very heart of Jewish mysticism, Merkabah mysticism, which would eventually be called Kabbalah. It would have another name before that, which would be the palaces, right? So it'd be Heklahot, which is palaces, the Heklahot literature. So you have three things that we know, okay, that even no matter how terrified the rabbis were, they would not write that shit down. It was too dangerous. The argument goes that the Zohar is that those three things finally put down in written form and needed at the time that it was needed it was written down. Again, we already had the conversation around the authorship of the Zohar. We won't get into that. Okay. So the Zohar expressly, by proof of its quote unquote divinity, has to discuss three things: sex, the account of creation, and the account of the chariot. And the account of the chariot is where, mysticism and I would also argue any of the advanced technology and other things that the Zohar discusses are all a part of that. Okay. So what is the purpose of the Talmud? Because the Talmud is not the same as the Zohar. And you actually have a large swath of Jews, even today, who would claim that the Zohar is not divinely inspired, and that the Talmud is the end of divine inspiration, or is more or less the divine inspiration, minus some, visions that people have of Elijah or something along those lines. Okay. So the Talmud, what is said in the Talmud? Yes, there are. It's basically a book of arguments. You've heard me talk about this before, but I want to get to the core purpose of the Talmud. Yes, the things that are said in the Talmud can matter, do matter. But remember, it's a book of arguments, so it's very rare that the Talmud actually comes to a conclusive statement, that it reveals some kind of truth, okay? Because you could pull it's like going on Twitter, and there's conservative Twitter there's conservative X and liberal X, and I wish it was ex-liberals and ex-conservatives. The world would be solved then, or the problems would be solved then. But regardless, you have conservative X and liberal X, and the two of them see things from two very different worldviews, but they both have facts to back them up, and they both, depending upon what you're reading, look like the truth. The Talmud operates in a very similar way, okay? And the funny thing is that the same conclusion that you really should come to if you ever go on X is the same conclusion that you should come to after you read the Talmud. Yes, there are little nuggets of truth within it, for sure, and worthwhile to pull out, and it does give commentary and whatever, and possibilities, and all of that has value. Again, remember, language is psychedelic, even in this, but in that, you know, you really can interpret things in multiple ways, and all of them can be right. So there's still value in the Talmud, but ultimately what the Talmud is for, what it is about not telling you the truth. It is about creating a mindset. It's the same thing that when you go on X, you should walk away from that. A, saying everybody's fucking insane. And B, you should walk away from critical thinking skill, or you should walk away with critical thinking skills. You should walk away with the ability, a different ability to think, an ability to see outside of the bullshit. And that's ultimately what Talmud is about. When you have people saying to you, or, you know, when you go, wow, how come so many Jews are Nobel Prize winners? How come so many Jews have contributed so much to science and, like, you know, or Oppenheimer and all this, and, you know, made these incredible leaps in thinking and science and so on. Why is this? Is it genetics? I'm not going to pin it to genetics. Okay. I'll pin it right down to the Talmud, which as certainly as Jewish boys, we get taught from start getting taught from a very early age, creates a universal way of thinking. Actually, an extra universal way of thinking. It creates a very specific mindset that allows you to see things in incredibly new ways. It allows you to see things from all sides. It allows you, it's understanding in 40 volumes, right? You know, the old saying, understanding is a three-edged sword, your side, their side, and the truth. Talmud teaches you how to see the third side. Same reason I always say to you, there's always at least three ways to do something, right? The Talmud effectively creates that mindset. It's like, wow, where does this guy, I'm not talking about me, I'm just saying, you know, where does this person come up with all these original ideas? And I'm not saying the Talmud's the only thing that can do this to you, okay? But the Talmud absolutely creates, you know, this mindset of ironically, because it's an Orthodox text, but an unorthodoxy of thought. That's what it's about. You could argue, it doesn't even really matter what it says on the inside. It doesn't matter what it's trying to say is right and true. The only truth to really come out of it is the mindset that it creates in the individual. That's the power. That's what's amazing about Talmud. Because it allows you to see everything. It allows you to see all of universe. I didn't say the. All of universe in a new way. Now, why are we covering all of this? Okay, why did I just go into this, I don't know, what, 20 minutes? 15-minute diatribe on the difference between Talmud, you know, and all this and what it's about? This might lead to what the question I may get to first, okay? But I'm bringing all of this up so that you understand that when somebody, you know, that not all of these texts are created equal. They have different purposes, arguably very different origins, especially when it comes to the first five books of the Bible, Torah, which the importance of Torah isn't so much even the stories within it. The importance are the letters themselves. Okay, the importance is the Hebrew lettering and all of that. And again, I've quoted this so many times, but I'll just say it again, that, you know, if we had a very famous rabbi, you know, over 1,000 years ago said, if you reordered the, you know, if you knew the proper order of the letters within Torah, you could create worlds. You could, you know, like your powers would be almost endless. Okay. But that's only the first five books of the Bible. That's only the Hebrew. You know, it's not to say that there aren't truths or things or whatever to glean from, you know, what it says and how it's arranged right now. But what's the real nuggets are within the Hebrew itself. Unfortunately, like I said earlier, it's not hard to learn, but keep in mind, language is psychedelic, and Hebrew and Torah certainly more so than most. Okay. So that's kind of the point I'm getting to now. Since we're having a conversation around Zohar and, you know, and where all of this comes from, let's go to the weekly Q&A questions, because this is the sequel question from last week's Q&A. Then I want to get into another very long, interesting diatribe from Jacob, who kicked off this conversation as well. Let's see. Well, here. Okay. Let me answer this one. This is kind of a shorter one. No, I'm not going to do it. It wasn't Jen. No, I'm going to save that. Okay. Yeah, here we go. This is the one I want. And this one's coming from SEC. So this is based on a comment that I had made in last week's Q&A. So check that out, the one before this one, where I had said, I had talked about animism, where I basically made the claim that Kabbalah is shamanism. And that part of the source is animism, you know, within that, because shamanism is animism. He said, could you expand on this? Also, what is beyond the universe? Okay, so I'm going to do this in reverse. First, I'm going to talk about what is beyond the universe. Then I'll talk about animism and what that and the importance of that. Okay, so what is beyond the universe? Beyond the universe. Now, I've had a lot of conversations, including on Into the Void, where we've talked about the concept of the Ein Sof. Okay. Now, when you read Torah, again, when you read it, especially in the original Hebrew, you will probably not find, outside of the exploration of this within the Zohar, which is part of the beauty of reading the Zohar, is because you are getting some comment or a lot of commentary on Torah and its mystical meanings. Okay. But when you actually read the Hebrew, the beginning of Genesis 1, verse 1, now, most people in English, in fact, even people who are atheists, know it very well, right? In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Okay. When you read the Hebrew straight, it does not say that. Okay. It says, in the beginning, the infinite created God. You see the difference? I know I've brought this up before, but we got to grok this. Okay. So, you know, we think in English, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. No. It's actually the reverse when you read it properly in Hebrew. It's, and this isn't up to debate. Like, again, rabbis who firmly believe in God and would not, you know, be down with this translation, they know that this is what it says. Okay. Not, you know, doing some word twisting here whatsoever. This is what the Hebrew says. In the beginning, the infinite created God. Okay. So, God is a created being. Whatever God happens to be, we'll talk about that. And that gets into the animism conversation. But what is the infinite? What is this infinite that created God? Now, I mean, one of the first problems is this idea of in the beginning. Now, you got to grok that when it says in the beginning, it doesn't mean the beginning of time. It means the beginning of the story. This is another part that people really don't get. Okay. Is Torah is not describing a really great literalness and linearalness. You know, it's not like creating this, you know, it is a scientific text, but it's also not a scientific text. Okay. It's also a mystical text. Right. And so when it says in the beginning, that doesn't mean that was the beginning of fucking everything. It doesn't mean that there's the Big Bang. In fact, I would argue that the Zohar and really Torah itself says there's not a Big Bang. Okay, what in the beginning, all that really means is it's the beginning of the story. Everything is stories, right? What defines us as a species is stories, our stories. It's what we're all about. It's why we're always hooked on them. Anyway, that's a completely separate subject to get into, but it's an important one. It's not saying the beginning of the universe. It's saying the beginning of the story. Okay, so in the beginning, the infinite created God. What does this mean? So the infinite, in fact, how you say infinity in Hebrew is Ein Sof. Okay, so we know what that is, what the Ein Sof is. It's in the name, right? Language is important. You should use what describes something. And so just, this is the point I was going to get to about universe. Okay, and I do want to talk about that. It plays into this conversation. Okay, because this is something that's, it's going to be a bit of a sea change in language that I use with you. Okay. So the infinite, the Ein Sof, is something that exists, like existed at least before God, or again, it created God. Okay. So what is the infinite? Now in Judaism and in the Zohar, essentially the infinite is something you can only apply negative attributes to. Doesn't mean that you can only apply bad things to it. No, quite the opposite. No, what it means is that you can't really say what it is. You can only say what it isn't. You can't really know it. You can only know what it's not. That's what I mean by negative attributes. Okay. So the Ein Sof, is this thing that exists outside of the universe. Okay. God that it created, it's going to take me a little time to get used to it too. Because I said the universe. I don't want to do that anymore. Okay. God created universe. The Ein Sof created universe. Universe is God. All right. As the common analogy that I've used, and look, folks, you know, proof by analogy isn't proof, but sometimes analogy is the only way we can really describe things. Okay. That's got to grok that. So the Ein Sof, I would argue, is a woman. Okay. Now, if we need to get into a scientific theorem for that to make you feel better about yourself, I'm not saying that to Sec. I'm saying that to just people in general. Sec's brilliant. I'm not ripping on him at all in any of this. Okay. The Ein Sof is akin to, shall we say, a woman. That woman is, in scientific terms, would be a fourth dimensional black hole. This idea that the universe came out of a fourth dimensional black hole is scientifically sound. Okay. The idea that what we live within is birthed out of this, you know, out of this fourth dimension is not controversial whatsoever. In fact, it's considered one of the leading and not disrespected either, theories, or alternative theories to the Big Bang of how universe got here. Okay. So for the universe to be a thing, okay, there would be, arguably, there would be something outside of it. Okay. Now, without getting into a bunch of quantum physics, cause I fucking hate that shit. I mean, no, quantum physics is real. I just don't like appealing to it when I don't need to. you have the Ein Sof. Okay. You have Ein Sof. And again, it is akin to a woman, and it births universe that we exist within. Okay. Universe is a superorganism. That also is not a controversial scientific statement to say that universe thinks, feels, operates like a body, like an organism. It's a superorganism. Okay. So universe comes out of the, you know, out of the vagina of the Ein Sof. Okay. And the irony is, and this is kind of where, you know, where I guess things would get weird. Well, we don't have to go there. Look, things are already weird. We don't have to necessarily go that distance. Okay. Maybe we do. Okay. So what is the purpose behind this? So universe exists between the legs of the Ein Sof. Okay. But it is that creation that Torah is talking about from the Ein Sof. So is this debunking my idea that I've always said that the universe has always been here? No. We've always been, it's always been. Okay. It might not have always been in this form, but universe has always been. Okay. There is a, again, analogy might be the only way that we can describe it. There is a goal of where to, effectively, to create more life. The sexual act, PIV, penis and vagina, has to occur. Right now, okay, now, I mean, and when you keep reading in the book of Genesis, it says that the universe, you know, is formless and void. That everything's, what is it, the firmament here, firmament below, firmament above, and all that shit, right? Okay. So the act of that creation of universe, okay, here's the rub, is that it actually wasn't complete. There was a day of rest, and you would argue that it was completed, but it really, really wasn't. Okay. There are shards. I'm trying to say all this in like 5 minutes, and it's so tough because there's so much to grok. Okay. All right. I'm going to try and simplify it. The purpose of universe, and thus part of our purpose, you could argue, even though you can do whatever you want. Okay. The purpose of universe is to promote more life. And it does that by universe having to be through what we've talked about in the past, repairing the universe, tikkun olam, causing the universe to become what it was meant to be, which is, frankly, a cock. It's meant. It's, it's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? No. It's the rooster, goddammit. The universe is meant to be the penis that goes in the vagina of the Ein Sof to promote even more life. Okay. And, you know, everybody talks, and it, I mean, it's almost hilariously in the very way that universe is described by scientists, right? Where the statement is that, oh, for some reason, universe is expanding. It's constantly expanding, right? It's growing. It's getting bigger. It's getting harder. It's getting ready to go in. Manned insertion pod. Here we go. Woo. Right. Good times. And that's in metaphor. what is being done here to promote more life. I've always told you that if there was an inherent good, the only inherent good is biodiversity. Okay. Your purpose, your cause, not your purpose. Let's forget about the term purpose. If you were to take up a cause, the only cause worthwhile, the only cause that you have is the promotion of life. Your cause is life itself. And that's part of what's being, you know, that's what the Zohar is effective. At the end of the day, what the Zohar is getting at, and it gets into a lot of details, talks about a lot of different things you can do, you know, and explains a lot. But at the end of the day, you know, in summation, the Zohar is the sexual act. The Zohar is, but it's the sexual act on the grandest scale. It is a multidimensional, not multiverse, a multidimensional sexual act occurring in that you are to promote, because you are to promote life. Now, what does that mean? That's a separate conversation to get into. Okay, like the cause of life. That's a very separate thing to get into. But that's what the Zohar is doing. Okay, so now hit the microphone. Okay, so let me go back to Sek's question here. What is beyond the universe? So that's what's beyond. At least what we can say it's not. What we can somewhat say about it, even though really we're just saying what it's not. What's beyond the universe is Ein Sof. Okay. I want to touch, you know, I was pulled, honestly, to the question, the other question that Sek had, which is, and I'll hit it here. Do you reject any concept of the multiverse? I reject any concept of multiverse in the Schrodinger's cat sense. Okay. And I've done the debunking on the concept of Schrodinger's cat, right? Like, you know, Feynman's path integral. Okay. Like that debunks the idea that there are universes where you're someone else, you know, like it just rips as good a movie as Everything Everywhere All at Once was. And it really is a great movie. You know, Feynman's path integral tears that to shreds. That's just not true. Or that, you know, this idea that there are universes where other yous exist. It's just not there. Okay. It's not a part of the program. But the idea that there could be the birthing of other universes, okay, other superorganisms from Ein Sof, sure, yeah, I guess I'm open to that. Like that, I suppose that would be, that's one of the possibilities of promoting life, would actually be creating other universes, but they are universes with other rules, okay? I mean, and this gets into, you know, some plays on the laws of thermodynamics that, and beyond that, where you could, if you superheated, right? If you superheated one singular point in universe, if you superheated it, I mean, you got it hot enough and you're in like your own little spaceship or something that was superheating it, you could actually tear outside of this universe, outside of universe. You could tear outside of it. And the argument would be, the scientific argument would be that you create your own in that sense. That's not you creating another you. That's you leaving this universe, creating another. Okay. Or perhaps entering another. So in that sense, I can be behind a concept of a multiverse, but that's not what people mean when they say multiverse. Okay. And that term is so poisoned. The term multiverse is so poisoned. It needs to stop. Like, just stop. It needs to just be stopped being used. Disney killed it. Not just Disney. Plenty of people did. But Disney is probably the worst. Okay. All right. We gotta keep going. So now in the, you know, and this is still true. I have argued that the Zohar, I consider it to be axiomatic. It's self-evident. It proves itself. Okay. It's an internalized truth. And the only way something can express truth is by whatever it is, being able to see all the angles. Okay. So the argument would go, you can't really know what's true in universe because you can't see outside of the universe to know, or outside of that universe to know. My argument is that the Zohar is, for lack of a better term, there is no God, but for lack of a better term, divinely inspired, or should I say extra universally inspired. It is text. It is words from, and this is paradoxical because it's words, but it's also not words. And this is going to get into our next subject as well, but we still got a little more to get into here. Okay. The Ein Sof inspired the Zohar, gave the Zohar. Okay. And so when you read the Zohar, which is commenting on Torah, so Torah would be a part of this. Torah is part of the Zohar, ultimately. Okay, at least the letters are, right? We already talked about how the letters are actually all in the wrong, and we're even missing letters, and we're missing books, and there's a lot of conversation to have around that I've had over the years on these Q&As, even on episodes of Sovereign Tech. But the Zohar is statements from outside of the universe by that which birthed. Created isn't even the right term. Really, it's just birth, because again, it was always there, it was always inside, but birthed universe that we exist within. Okay, so that's where I say that the Zohar is axiomatic. That's what's beyond. All right, is the Ein Sof, you know, is the best way that we can describe it is a fourth dimensional black hole, and universe exists. You know, what we live within, the superorganism that is universe, exists in the corona of that black hole. Again, that's not even a controversial statement to make based upon our understanding of physics and the evidence that's presented to us or that we have. It's not controversial. So yes, what is outside of it? I mean, if I was going to get, you know, I would say Ein Sof. If I wanted to be scientific, it'd be a fourth dimensional black hole. Or again, that's the best. In fact, it's so perfect. It's so funny to me because you have the mystics for thousands of years saying you can't really say what infinity is. You can't say what the Ein Sof is, but we can say what it's not. And like a black hole, in a way, well, yes, you can say what a black hole is, but can you say what's inside of a black hole? No, nobody really knows. And it's not like that Disney movie, as cool as that was, with Ernest Borgnine, right? It's so funny because like they match up. The descriptions match up in that you can't really know what, you know, we could talk about kind of what emanates from it, right? Like the Sephiroth, the 10 Sephiroth. We could talk about emanations. We could talk about aspects, but we can't really know the wholeness of it. And that's just as true when we talk about black holes. That's not even getting into white holes. That's a whole other conversation. But anyway, yeah. So that's what's on the outside. Now we're going to get into animism. No, let's get into animism first, okay? Animism. So I'm going to pull up, going to go right off of Wikipedia, as problematic as Wikipedia can be. I'm going to go right off of Wikipedia just to describe what animism is, and then, you know, I'll talk about, you know, why I brought it up. Animism. Animism is the belief that objects, places, and creatures all possess a distinct spiritual essence. Animism perceives all things, animals, plants, rocks, rivers, weather systems, human handiwork, and in some cases, words, as animated and alive. Animism is used in anthropology of religion as a term for the belief, here's the key part, for the belief system of many indigenous peoples, in contrast to the relatively more recent development of organized religions. Next key part, animism focuses on the metaphysical universe, specifically on the concept of the immaterial soul. So again, soul is a separate conversation that I've had. But where they get into it, let me see if that, yeah, okay, here's the key part that I want. Although each culture has its own mythologies and rituals, animism is said to describe the most common foundational thread of indigenous people's spiritual or supernatural perspectives. That's the key point right there. Okay, so animism is Prisca Theologia, right? Kabbalah is Judaism. Judaism is Kabbalah. Kabbalah is Prisca Theologia, right? Prisca Theologia is this the original spirituality that I've talked about for the past 10 years. Okay. This is the original spirituality. And Kabbalah is ultimately, again, we're building up, it's not a hierarchy, but we're going up the ladder here. Okay. Kabbalah is ultimately shamanism, and shamanism is ultimately animism. Animism is the idea that within everything is the spiritual. In fact, I love that Wikipedia even says, even within words, there is a spiritual essence, right? Which that would make sense based upon, you know, the argued powers and power of even the Hebrew alphabet itself, you know, and that's without getting into the idea, you know, it's not something I talk, it's not something I talk a lot about, because it gives too much credit to people who are just dead wrong and that I've already debunked countless times. You know, people who believe in simulation theory and the idea that we live inside of a computer. Now, they like to quote, there are certain scientists who have come out, who I respect, who have, or researchers, I should say, who have come out and said that we have noticed that there is a code in the universe. We're finding what appears to be computer code within the universe, right? In fact, there's a famous moment where this very scientist was saying it to Neil deGrasse Tyson on stage. And this is not a religious guy whatsoever. You know, and this is often famously used to, you know, by some people who are into simulation theory to say, ah, see, there it is. There's the computer code. No, it's not a computer. It's not computer code. In Zohar and Talmud, you know, the idea that the universe itself is composed of the Hebrew alphabet is widely espoused. And so the idea that, oh, suddenly researchers are finding that the universe is based upon, like, there's some kind of code there. Well, you're 2,000, 3,000 years late to the party, motherfucker. My people already knew that. But it's not a computer. Okay, it's just, like, if you're detecting anything, arguably you're detecting the power of the Hebrew alphabet. So, you know, this idea that words have a spiritual, you know, certain words or certain letters and all this has some kind of, you know, animistic nature to it. Yeah, absolutely. So animism. So just to describe it, the reason I brought up animism is, again, animism is at its core. Like, that's the core of shamanism. Again, Kabbalah is effectively shamanism, just in a way more systematized. I do want to have a conversation around systematized here as well. How long is this episode going to go? But I want to get into this stuff. I want to have this conversation because it's a flowing conversation. Okay. So animism, yeah, is the idea that you know, everything, it's, what do they call that? Is that pan psychic, where, like, there's consciousness in everything? Well, again, consciousness itself is a, element's not the right term. Particle is not the right term. Consciousness is a, shall we say, it is an energy, okay? It is a thing, just like I think love is an actual thing that exists. It's an energy that exists in the universe that you can harness. Consciousness is the same deal, right? That is panpsychism, isn't it? Anyway, or, you know, hell, does it sound like the force? Yep. So yeah, so that this is all running through everything, okay? And why would this be true? Because, again, animism is effectively saying that that universe is a superorganism. Okay. So animism is just another term for all this stuff. That's the only reason I really bring it up, but it is a anthropological concept. Like, nobody, I hear spiritual nut job or gurus, same thing. who will talk about the animistic nature of things. And, you know, maybe they've kind of like brushed off on me a little bit just because, you know, like I've used the term before in the past as well, saying that animism is the original religion, right? Or, you know, it is the Prisca Theologia. Like, that's not a new statement for me to make, but animism is ultimately, it's just an anthropological term. Like, nobody out there, again, minus those spiritual gurus, says that they're an animist. Like, there's no religion of animism. Okay. It's just an anthropological term to describe this notion that everything has a spiritual essence to it. Now, when I say it has a spiritual essence, I mean that it is part of this super organism that is universe. Okay. And that's the only reason I bring up animism, is its anthropological context. So, you know, not that it's like some kind of actual faith or anything, or that it's a religion or that it's anything like that. Okay. So let's talk about, why am I saying universe and not the? Now, I shared this point. It was a post that I made on Threads. And of course, why am I on Threads? It's because it's actually going to be part of the Fediverse. So, you know, it's going to use ActivityPub eventually. If it doesn't, then I'll, you know, maybe get off of it or just stop using it, whatever. Make my, you know, account null. I know you can't get rid of it and get rid of your Instagram at the same time, but whatever. Anyway, I know who's been doing a tech show for over 10 years. I think that's the guy in the chair here. Anyway, so I made this post on Threads where I was talking about, and I'll get to, so here we go. I'll just read it for you. Okay. Because I know not all of you are in the Discord channel where I shared it. And this is me writing this. Okay. This is my point. I mean, I'm borrowing it from, or not borrowing, but like kind of the overall gesture. Well, I'll talk about where that comes from, but it won't surprise you. Here we go. What is in a name? Everything. But most importantly, recognition and respect. Recognition that you are a sovereign organism and respect of your individuality. Giving something a unique name, pets, children, etc., is a powerful recognition. And capitalizing the first letter is a show of respect. Okay, so I'm going to break in for a second. So, for example, my name is Brian. You usually capitalize the B when you write my name. This has been actually since the dawn of the internet and people talking textually more than via voice, you know, vocally. It's been a common thing to, if you want to make fun of someone, don't capitalize the first letter in their name. You know, like that's been around for a very long time with the internet, especially. So anyway, capitalizing the first letter is a show of respect. Our universe is a super organism. Stop disrespecting it by calling it, quote, the universe, end quote. It's universe, capital U. Give universe the recognition of a proper name and you may just understand existence better. And that was the post that I made. And that's the thing. Like, I want to stop saying the in front of it because it is a super organism. Okay. Saying the Ayin Sof, I think, is different because that's as much title as it is reference to the existence. You know, it's like saying, the king. Okay. When you say the Ayin Sof, you are referencing both. I mean, because it doesn't really have a name. So you sort of have to say the. Right? Like, we call it Ein Sof, but that's more of a title. It's akin to saying king or queen or something like that. And I guess arguably you'd be queen, but anyway, that's language is so important because when you start to use language properly, okay, again, if it's being used and implemented properly, you have an instant understanding of how things work. So if you, for example, In the tech world, I have staunchly stood against removing the words of master and slave from computer technology. Like a master hard drive and a slave hard drive, or a master, or like motherboard and daughterboard, you know, like all these terms, keep these terms there because they explain the relationship that and we're not going to say dominant hard drives and submissive hard drives. We're just not going to say that. It's different than that. Okay. Like submissive doesn't do enough. Okay. Master and slave accurately describe how computer technology works when it's applied within that context. Okay. I've always stood up for that because it helps people to understand what the fuck it's doing. In the same sense, to grok, to understand that what we exist within, what the, you know, cosmos that we can see, or that we can not necessarily see, you know, but that we can verify, or that you know, that we can encounter, measure, actually that's the word I wanted, that we can measure, is a superorganism. And we have the research to back that up. Might still be a little theoretical, but I would say we have the research to back it up, that our universe is a superorganism. So you should call it exactly what it, you know, you should give it the respect of it being a sovereign organism and respect its individuality. And do so by calling it by its name. And universe is beautiful, like Sek brought up, you know, it means one song. And it's a love song, by the way. I mean, that's not what it means, but that's what it is. P-I-V, baby. Anyway, but it's one song. It's a great name. Okay, call it what it is. Call it, reference it in the context of the language that you use. When you start calling universe by a name, writing it down as a name, you are recognizing it as the sovereign being that it is. And you are going to start understanding perhaps your role within it. I've talked about the theory that you are, that humanity, and among other things, are part of the immune system of universe. Again, giving it a name and the respect is key to getting that understanding. Now, I'm not the first person to come up with this. The first person to come up with this is the same guy who enlightened me to the notion that love could be the same, could be a force in the universe just like gravity. That is none other than one of the most brilliant people to ever walk this planet, that being Buckminster Fuller. Buckminster Fuller referenced universe as universe, capital U. So I'll give credit where it's due. I always do. He had a lot of other really cool ideas as far as language goes. And why? Because he was buddies with one of my schoolmasters, who I consider, you know, one of my thought, one of the people who taught me so much, not directly, only through his works, but that being Alfred Korzybski. Buckminster Fuller was a huge believer in general semantics, which I have been espousing forever. Okay. So it's all coming from the same spot. And that's kind of the whole point of general semantics is, you know, that's why you have the language like E prime and everything. It's defining things. Okay. It's using language to accurately describe your experience with the thing before you. And so Buckminster Fuller calling the universe, universe, is A, genius, B, accurate. Accurate well before we were doing the research to suggest that universe was a superorganism. So I am doing my best going forward to reference the universe as universe to more accurately. I mean, it might sound funny to you at first, but use it for a little while. Okay. And I think you'll find it rolls off the tongue and it does change your perspective. It changes your mind. It gives you an experience, a psychedelic experience, right? That's the whole point, is it makes you see the world in a new way. That's a psychedelic. That is abstractly a psychedelic experience, if not. Because it doesn't use psychedelics, but it does use language to create the same thing. See how this is playing off what we were talking about earlier, right? I told you this is all running together. Okay. So that's a key thing that I want to do going forward. I mean, I'm so used to saying the universe that, you know, I'm sure I'll slip up here and there, but eventually it'll become habit. Now, speaking of language, and I guess we're going to go long on this one, but I want to get this out. I want to answer these questions. These are great questions. They're important. And I want to talk about them. Language in itself, as you can see in much of what we just discussed here, let alone things we've talked about many times over the years, language in itself is a problem, right? Alfred Korzybski recognized this, you know, Science and Sanity is an incredibly long text. You don't even need Science and Sanity to like really grok, you know, to understand general semantics. But you go through that book and by the end of it, you're going to be like, oh man, language sucks. And it does. At the end of the day, I think it does. Which leads to our next question. Okay, from Jacob in the Discord. And this is, I'm going to read his question. You're going to, you'll find out why this flows with what we're talking about. Okay. And then, and anyway, I'll get into some oddities around it and we'll break it down. So here it is. Lord Sovereign. So Yukio Mishima, yay or nay? the answer is both. We will talk about, all right. Well, actually before I get into the rest of his question, no, I'll read the rest of the question. Then we'll talk. Okay. Here he continues, but seriously, to expand on that, I watched Paul Schrader's, Mishima film, just last month. And Justin Sledge released a video on his Sun and Steel essay last week. That being, Mishima-san's, Sun and Steel, essay. Knowing your love of Japan, reading on with Jacob here, knowing your love of Japan, I'd be surprised if you didn't have at least some cursory knowledge of Mishima. I'm quite unfamiliar with him myself, but since I came across him twice in 1 month, I figured I'd ask you whether or not he has influenced your thinking in any way. Obviously, much of his philosophy is directly contradictory to your views, such as his insistence that a glorious death is a good thing, and not to mention his political views tended toward fascistic at minimum. Yeah, I can certainly see him becoming an influence among today's reactionaries if he's not already, but his, quote, mysticism of the flesh, end quote, seems reminiscent of some of your thoughts. So is there any connection there, or is it just a coincidence? Well, Jacob, as you know, because I responded in the Discord channel already, no, it's not a coincidence whatsoever. So as I shared with Jacob in the Discord, I said, are you ready for a mindfuck? And I shared with him a piece from my Medium page, which itself was a reposting of a piece that I did almost a year ago, called in for the Sovereign Technical newsletter for the spirituality section called The Temple of Flesh and Steel. Now, the reason that I shared that story or that article that I wrote, The Temple of Flesh and Steel, is because within it, I directly quote Mishima-san. So, and of course, Jacob's like, I swear to God, I didn't read that essay. I'm like, I know you didn't. It's okay. And I don't expect everybody to listen to or even read everything that I put out there. I know I put out so much. So what was really funny is, so I also watched Justin Sledge's, he did a, you know, on esotericism or Esoterica, his YouTube channel, he did a video on Sun and Steel, just 6 days ago, just last week. I also watched it. I thought it was very well done. But here's the even funnier part. I shared, reposted from the newsletter onto Medium, my piece that quoted Mishima the same day, just hours before Justin Sledge released his video. I didn't know he was releasing that video, right? I sure as hell didn't know when. No clue. So just a bit of odd synchronicity there. That was the mindfuck, you know? Now the piece that I wrote, let me go to that. Okay. I'm going to answer Jacob's question. We're going to get into it and I'm going to talk some about, might review slightly some of, again, Sledge does great work. Even if I disagree with him, perhaps even a lot of times, he does great work. Okay. And I don't really have anything to disagree with him on in the Sun and Steel thing, though I do disagree with Mishima, as Jacob accurately predicted. I'll talk about that. So the piece I wrote that quotes Mishima, that I wrote long before Sledge did this video, is The Temple of Flesh and Steel. And it was more or less a piece about going to the gym, about working out, the importance of your physical body. Now, me talking about the importance of the physical body is not new to anybody. And you didn't need this Medium piece to know that that's how I feel about things. I always talk about this. I always say what most religions, spiritual practices, and so on, what they get wrong is they deny the body. They ignore the body. They say the body doesn't matter. And I say that's dead wrong. Okay. And Mishima would as well. So, anyway, let's see. Yeah, here, I'm going to read from my piece from the Temple of Flesh and Steel. Why do I bother to bring this up? Because I think the language of the body is often ignored and underdeveloped. And that language of the body, that language is as important to your spiritual wellness and being as any other language, whether verbal or internal. As one of the great 20th century authors, Yukio Mishima, put it in their classic essay, Sun and Steel, quote, "The groups of muscles that have become virtually unnecessary in modern life, though still a vital element of a man's body, are obviously pointless from a practical point of view. And bulging muscles are as unnecessary as a classical education is to the majority of practical men. Muscles have gradually become something akin to classical Greek. To revive the dead language, the discipline of steel was required. To change the silence of death into the eloquence of life, the aid of steel was essential," end quote. Now I'm going to read a little bit more of what I've written. Here we go. Quote, "Really, that change death into the eloquence of life hits it, and everything else I could say is merely commentary. But as I'm wont to do, I will comment anyway. You see, part of Mishima-san's point was that modern civilization had taken something away from the human condition with all of its, as I call them, capitalist creature comforts. The body no longer developed in a way that allows it to fully engage with the world around it. Not only that, but the lack of the human body's development keeps one from being able to hear what your body is telling you, as well as keeping the body from serving the individual in an autonomic way." Now, autonomic is just a fancy way of saying automatic process. Okay. But anyway, so this is what I hit at. And notice how we were just talking about what is the cause? The cause is the promotion of life. And what is Mishima-san saying in Sun and Steel? He's saying change death into the eloquence of life. Okay. Now, so I don't know where to start with this. Like, I kind of want to get into my history with Mishima, but I also want to explain where I agree with Mishima, you know, and some thoughts on it and so on. I think that, because I already gave you some connective tissue, so I'm going to get into a bit of when I experienced Mishima-san. So Yukio Mishima, he lived, primarily, like, grew up, you know, even during World War II. In fact, he wanted to be a kamikaze pilot. he is considered one of the greatest writers in history, just not just Japanese, just anywhere. And he is a great writer. He truly is, or truly was. He died at the age of 45. He was born, I want to say, in 1925. Sun and Steel came out in 1968, something like that. Okay. His point, and I should link to, because Sledge would do a much better and more succinct job than I would. His point, Mishima's point in Sun and Steel. Okay. I'll link to the video as well, so you can, you know, listen to that. But his point was that, like I had pulled from that quote, you know, that we are ignoring the body, but it's still necessary. And he has this idea that language, that written language, the written word, the spoken word even, is what he would call the white ants. Okay. It is the white ants of language that, you know, that eat away at you and keep you from experiencing universe itself. Okay. That's kind of the quote that I pulled from. So what you need to do is, in the modern world, because modern life doesn't lead you to developing your body. Okay. Unless, you know, again, we're talking about modern creature comforts, even in the early parts of the 20th century, you have to go to the gym. You have to, you know, it's the caress of steel, right? Like Manowar would say, you have to take that on, you know, lift weights and develop the body so that, you know, the way that the body evolved, you know, cause our bodies didn't evolve to sit in cubicles for 9 hours a day, right? They evolved for so much more. And Mishima was about recapturing that even before cubicles became a thing. Or perhaps just as they were becoming a thing. So I read Mishima when I was a teenager. And it really, really influenced me. Now, part of why I read Mishima was because I did have, as a teenager, I did have such a fascination with Japan and would have the fortunes of going to Japan many times, including as a teenager. I wanted to, like, understand, you know, so, okay. Look, quick timeline. Third grade. All right. Third grade. We used to have in schools, we would have these, you'd have book drives, right? Scholastic. That was the name of the company, Scholastic, I believe. They'd have these book drives. And okay, so first off, I'm, you know, of course, I'm Jewish. And so I'm looking at all these books that you can buy at the time. So, you know, I'm a little kid. All right. And I see this book called the Complete Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And it was like $3.25. I'll never forget it. That was kind of expensive at the time. But anyway, it was like $3.25. Now, what attracted me was it said complete. And of course, I'd known about Sherlock Holmes because, you know, Mr. Data in The Next Generation would play, you know, would act as Sherlock Holmes all the time. So I knew Sherlock Holmes. And so I'm like, oh, well, I'll get this. I get to read about Sherlock Holmes. I get to do all that. But the big thing for me was that I was getting bang for my buck. I was getting so much book compared to the rest of the, all the other books had pretty pictures and all that bullshit. Sure. But I'm getting like hundreds of pages and I'm getting the complete thing. So this is way more worth my money. That's what's going, believe me, even as a Jewish kid, trust me, that goes through your head, even in third grade. Okay. And now, you know, in fact, I've brought this up before that if you ever wanted, you know, we were just talking about what's the beauty of Talmud, right? The beauty of Talmud is that it creates a certain mindset. The works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle do the same thing, or do similar, I guess I should say. They create a foundation of logic in the human mind. I have always said, if you wanted to teach kids something, if you want to be a good steward to children, okay, and that's steward, not parent, not to lord over them, but to guide them, just guide them, okay? Protect them where needed, but mainly guide them. Teach them how to read. Okay, teach them language, give them that psychedelic experience, teach them how to read, and then, and when they learn how to read, when it makes sense, it may not be third grade, but when it makes sense, give them Sherlock Holmes. Okay, the original canon of Sherlock Holmes, none of the new shit, give them the classics. And that will develop a young mind so fucking amazing. I've seen it countless times. So, and, you know, sure, Talmud could do the same thing, but that's a separate conversation and a lot more complex. And, you know, the whole Talmud thing, that really gets into, like, why is there this, even when I would argue that the great sages and the great rabbis and whatever all knew that God didn't exist, why are they still pushing this idea of faith and of God? And there's something to get into with that as to why they do that, even though I disagree with them, but it has to do with teaching children. But that's another conversation for another time. Okay. So I get Sherlock Holmes. All right. And I read the fuck out of that. So at the time, you know, the things I'm really into, Star Trek, G.I. Joe, Star Wars, of course, is massive, huge for me. You know, and Sherlock Holmes, like this is my life. Okay. And yeah, Ninja Turtles were there too, but this is my life. Okay. And suddenly in the 90s, new Star Wars books come out. You got to understand, as I've said many times, as Rob and I have said many times, there was no other Star Wars. There was no other Star Wars. Stop it. We have too much today. But back then there just was nothing. So when a new Star Wars book came out, it fucking meant something. Okay. Because it had been years since there was anything Star Wars. So Heir to the Empire comes out by Timothy Zahn. Book is gigantic. Hundreds and hundreds of pages. I mean, it's just a massive tome. And I'm looking at it. You know, I remember going grocery shopping with my mother and I see Heir to the Empire and I see the logo for Star Wars. Even if I couldn't, I mean, I could read it at the time very well, but even if I couldn't, I, you know, your eyes are just going to catch that font, right? That classic font. And I see Star Wars and I'm like, well, I don't know if I can take this size of a book on because it's not a bunch of short stories like Sherlock Holmes. Like, I don't know if I can do this, but I have to have it. And so my mother buys it for me. And I do start reading it. And I did a whole book report on it in third grade and everything. This wasn't too far after reading the Sherlock Holmes canon. And I read about the character of Grand Admiral motherfucking Thrawn. I know it's Mithran Rodo, but I think it might actually just be maybe the best way to translate that is motherfucking Thrawn. And so I read about this character, Thrawn. And as I've said in the past, you know, Thrawn's my favorite Star Wars character, ultimately. Thrawn is effectively Sherlock Holmes in space. And I couldn't put that together at the time consciously, but unconsciously I knew that. And so I'm just totally attracted to this character of Grand Admiral Thrawn. Now, what does all this have to do with Mishima-san? Trust me, there's a point. Okay. So I get this, right? And then, oh man, then Star Wars games start becoming more of a thing. Okay. And we're talking the big games, you know, X-Wing, TIE Fighter, X-Wing Alliance, Jedi Knight, you know, all that jazz, Dark Forces, all that jazz. Okay. And so, you know, here I am in this, you know, childish crush over Grand Admiral Thrawn. And then I end up getting TIE Fighter, the game Star Wars TIE Fighter, you know, the CD-ROM version in 94. So I'm 13 years old, you know, for PC, I put it in. And right in the opening sequence, motherfucker, there's Grand Admiral Thrawn. I'm in, and I'm just ecstatic. I'm just like, oh yes. Funny that I use the word ecstatic, but I'm so excited. And that effectively makes me a fan of the Galactic Empire for the rest of my life. Right there. Now, why is Star Wars so crucial? I've actually told the story in other podcasts that I've been on. In the past, I'm not going to rehash that here. That's another story. Okay. But there's actually a very deep, almost traumatic reason why I'm into Star Wars. That has to do with my binky of all things from when I was 3 years old, but that another story. Okay. So I'm totally into the Empire, totally into Grand Admiral Thrawn. Okay. And this is sticking with me, and the Star Wars books that are coming out during my teenage years are just some of the greatest books fucking ever and still are, and blow away anything Disney's ever done. Okay. So, you know, a few years later, I'm getting into anime, you know, getting into Japanese culture overall. And I start reading, you know, like I learn about this author, Mishima. Now, people call Sun and Steel a book, but Yukio Mishima's Sun and Steel is really just, it is more accurately called an essay. Okay. And that's what Jacob called it. And that's what it should be called. It's very short. It's not long at all. You know, the audiobook version of it, which I don't know if there's an official one, but you know, I doubt it's an hour long. Okay. So I start with the short stuff because I like things that I can read, you know, in one sitting at the time. I really do. I mean, I like long stuff too, but anyway, I got things to do. I'm a kid or a teenager at the time. So I'm a teenager and I start reading Sun and Steel. And, you know, basically what I am reading in Mishima-san's Sun and Steel is a combination. It is a philosophy that is a combination of, because the other thing I forgot to mention that I was into, is a combination of He-Man and the Galactic Empire, ultimately. That's what he's writing. And so did that appeal to teenage me? Holy fuck. You bet. You bet. Like, I get it, you know, I mean, and even his notion of the glorious death and all this other stuff, like, you know, kind of buying into this idea of serving the Empire, you know, and learning more about Mishima-san's life and everything at the time for me. Again, I'm a, you know, somewhat impressionable young kid, but at the time, you know, I'm getting into this and boy, it really hits. Fortunately, it doesn't hit for too long. Not all of it anyway. It doesn't hit for too long because at the same time, I actually, you know, as a teenager, not long after I am, you know, I'm starting to read, believe it or not, philosophical texts, you know, I'm actually reading Nietzsche as a teenager and I'm, you know, reading so much more. And I start, you know, this is also when I start reading Kabbalah and start to understand Kabbalah. And in so doing, Kabbalah takes, for me, it took Mishima-san's works and just, you know, It transmogrifies it. Like it turns it into, it chips away at the bullshit. It chips away at the glorious death. But the part that always stuck with me is that turning death, you know, into life. That's really so key. You know, it's changed the silence of death into the eloquence of life. The aid of steel was essential. So I start working out, you know, like, this was a really, really big deal for me. I know you might think it's crazy to read this stuff as a young kid, but again, when you're going through, like, especially a more classical Jewish education growing up, I mean, this stuff isn't that out of bounds. Okay. Yeah, it really struck me at the time. And it also got me into, because, you know, I'm growing up and I'm a nerd, right? And being into physicality wasn't necessarily so much my thing, but I mean, other than being a great roller skater, but it does get me, you know, into like, oh no, I have an appreciation for this. I have an appreciation for the body. I have appreciation for, you know, action movies and really like Mishima-san. I mean, he would be in his own action movies. Like he was this about all of this. And it kind of inspired that. In fact, at some point, you know, I do want to write a piece about like the spirituality of action films, because it is there, the mysticism of action films, because it's in there, whether people realize it or not. So what ends up happening, okay, within this is, you know, I'm reading this and I am so appreciative of this language of the body, this concentration on beauty, you know, even though it might sound superficial, it's actually not, okay, that, you know, that the Mishima-san is putting out there. And again, for me, you know, some of the like his more like fashy, you know, some of his more fascist tendencies was kind of, you know, it was sort of appealing to my fantasy life of the Galactic Empire, right? Of being a TIE fighter pilot. In fact, it's not an interesting note that Mishima, you know, directly said, in fact, Justin Sledge talks about this in Esoterica, you know, like that the one moment he had of like that perfect moment in life of mysticism was when he was in a jet plane. In fact, it was a jet plane. I think that the model was called a starfighter of all things. And that was very, like, I understood that because, you know, yeah, okay, we look at the cute computer graphics from the 90s and even the Star Wars flight simulator games then, and it's like, boy, that doesn't look real. But for a child, it's very real. It's real enough. The experience is enough. The feeling of motion, the music change, everything, it feels enough. And so, like, I could totally relate with this. Okay, I know you're thinking it's crazy that a teenager would do this. Oh, no. Yeah, you absolutely would. I mean, it's not crazy. In high school, we all are, you know, in most English courses, we're taught to read philosophers, you know, and or we're forced to even, you know, it's not that outlandish. Anyway, I mean, this is just, again, it was really, really hitting with me. Okay. But I'm totally buying into this, you know, the language of the body that Mishima-san is talking about. And what it clicks for me is when I'm learning about Kabbalah, you know, and so much more. I mean, this is the same time that I'm also reading Zachariah Sitchin, who we mentioned earlier. And fortunately, you know, at the time, like not long after, I would get the pleasure of even as a young man, you know, again, getting to become friends with Sitchin. But what I recognize is when he's talking about the language of the body, and you gotta get what Mishima-san is talking about. He's saying that words, you know, actual written down language he's saying it's basically, it's bullshit. It's keeping you from developing the real language, the feeling, the experience, the sensation. So the sensational, as in the senses, the sensational that you can experience, that is something that is ineffable. It is beyond words. He's recognizing this. Okay. Now, if I'm saying things that sound like, oh, wait, yeah, but Brian's always said that on Sovereign Tech, right? Exactly. Yes, I have. Okay. And it gets worse because what I am seeing in Mishima-san's work is he's talking about Chokmah consciousness. Now, if you go to my medium, and you read this, you know, Temple of Flesh and Steel, not far from it, you'll see where I did a write-up a year ago in the Sovereign Technica newsletter about Chokmah and Binah consciousness, right? So there's in Kabbalah, you have over 30 different types of consciousness. Two of the most important are Chokmah consciousness and Binah consciousness, right? Okay, so Binah consciousness is conscious wisdom. It is, Binah consciousness is what you're in usually every day. You know, to quote the Matrix, it's when you go to work, when you pay your taxes, you know, all that. Like that's Binah consciousness, existing here in the material, recognizing what's going on around you. Chokmah consciousness is a consciousness. This is what, remember earlier we were talking about Abulafian meditation, where you jumble up the words so that you can get beyond the words. Chokmah consciousness is you experiencing universe in its totality, in its wholeness. And it is a complete, there are no words. There's the broken divide doesn't matter at this point, right? I've talked about that many times. All there is the sensations, the sensual. That's all there is. And that's exactly, like, I mean, you know, Mishima-san even uses the words erotic and so on. And it matches completely with this, what the mystics were trying to achieve in getting to Hokmah consciousness. And that's what Mishima-san, when I read about his language of the body, he's essentially talking about, and this is exactly what I've been telling all of you, is that the body matters. The body is essential to ascending. It's a part of the ascension. It doesn't disappear. It is a part of the ascension. You could say that, you know, Justin Sledge talks about Mishima-san's mysticism, or mysticism of the flesh, as he called it, which I love that. That it's an anti-ecstatic experience. You know, you can still have what I think could be called an ecstatic experience, but it's, you know, it most of the time it is with your body. There is the possibility to have like experiences somewhat outside of it, but that's a whole other conversation. Anyway, the point being, I totally got my Hebrew education absolutely prepared me and allowed me to recognize what Mishima-san was saying. So I take his mysticism of the flesh minus this idea that the flesh decays, the flesh will no longer be a thing, you know, and that's where I have, as well as the fascism, that's where I have problems today, you know, with Mishima-san's points. Okay. I take all that on and I'm like, yeah, but we don't have to lose the body because, you know, like there are people who according to the mystics, who never died. Right. We have Enoch, we have Elijah, we have, you know, so many other figures or even if they did die, there, you know, there's this idea that, well, yeah, but some of these people live for hundreds of years, you know, or so on, or how, you know, Kabbalah makes it clear that, you know, it doesn't say that necessarily it's eternal life. It just effectively is eternal life and that you could live for over 1 million years. That's like almost an exact number that's within Kabbalah. So, you know, this idea, Mishima-san's fear that the beauty of the body and the strength of the body decays is wrong when colored with the rest of the truth. He only had half of it, but he had a beautiful half, a rare half, because he recognized the beauty and importance and power of the body, of the physical body. So, yeah, I mean, like it just, it clicked. And it present Mishima-san with his incredible grasp of language and to the point nature of his language as to where, you know, most of Kabbalah is like all wrapped up in so much, you know, stuff. And you have to have such a background of knowledge. It really hit me hard, you know, and it sticks with me. And I think he's, in the sense of the mysticism of the flesh, he's completely right. Where he's wrong is in the idea of the glorious death. But, you know, like even then, the way that he writes about it and talks about it, there is a certain beauty in that, because he is, even in his sense of the glorious death, he's still talking about, albeit unfortunately from a fascistic lens, he's talking about it in the sense of, he is talking about a certain type of tikkun olam, right? Where his death allows something bigger than me to go on. Okay. And tikkun olam is somewhat about that like your actions, okay, are helping repair the universe. And that's kind of what he was looking at. But for him, his universe was Japan. That's where his love was. That's you know, the sickness of the parasite of patriotism. So, unfortunately, because again, like he's so on. And so I want to talk about this a little bit more, though, just to show you how much it's colored so much of what I talk about, this mysticism of the flesh. OK, because not just in the recent newsletter, but I used to do a newsletter years ago back in 2017, 2018. OK, and I would do short fiction back then. In fact, all that short fiction has been collected into a book. It's available on Amazon. Have a good time if you really want it. It's not expensive. and it's what is it? The Sovereign Universe, Volume 1. Anyway, in that, there's a story that I wrote years ago called Anoesis. Now, the term Anoesis means the sensational, okay? Anoesis, you know, it's funny. We think, particularly anthropologically, in religious studies, okay, you have Gnosticism, you know, especially when you're looking at Christianity, you have Gnosticism. And then you have what you would call more traditional, or more accurately, rational Christianity. That's what they would call it. Okay. Or that's what a lot of anthropologists would call it. And the argument would be that, you know, that traditional Christianity is the antithesis. It's the opposite to Gnosticism. That is not true. The actual opposite of Gnosticism, and this is just true for many religions that have like a, shall we say, a Gnostic bent and then a rational bent. Okay. The actual opposite of Gnosticism, because rationality is its own problem. Yes, it is. Okay. The actual opposite of Gnosticism, of gnosis, which gnosis just means knowledge. Okay. In a dictionary definition, it just means knowledge. Sounds like Bina, right? Okay. Yeah, you got it. The opposite of gnosis is anoesis. It's such a weird word and nobody says it. So like I've pronounced it like two or three different times, but that was the title of a story I did now. And you can read in the story and it's an erotic story, of course, because again, everything is, you know, the existence of universe is a sexual act in itself. Okay. So everything is kind of about sex, right? Quantum hedonism. Everything is attraction. Everything is getting close, pulling to each other. Anyway. Okay. So eroticism, part eros, part of the universe, right? As some other rabbis would say, who I don't agree with on everything. Anyway. So eroticism. So it's an erotic story. Okay. Sorry. Just got to get back. We're talking big stuff. So it's an erotic story, of course, like most of my fiction is, frankly. And in this story, it is about, actually a stripper. It's about two characters, Agent Sovereign, another character getting away and, kind of, you know, and then this stripper character just feeling this tremendous pull towards Agent Sovereign and the other character. And they all end up having sex. Okay. Ends up being a threesome. And you know, my stories are always kind of tongue in cheek in a way, like kind of a James Bond, almost tongue in cheek. That's on purpose because, you know, being sarcastic or being a bit tongue in cheek, being kind of funny about things allows you to slip in truths. You know, it's like the bite of a tick, right? Why do ticks, why don't we feel them when they bite us? You know, how does their, you know, what they inject in us, how does it get through our system so quickly and so easily? It's because the saliva, sneaks it all in. The saliva like turns off our sensory organs. And, you know, so we don't feel it. Like your hairs could still feel it, but your skin can't, you know, your dermal layer can't feel it, right? It slips it in. It's a bit of a Trojan horse. Okay. Comedy, tongue in cheek, can be a Trojan horse for massive ideas. All right. And I've always used it, particularly in, you know, particularly in my fiction. Anyway, so it's always kind of tongue in cheek, but there's always some truth in there. Now within that story, anoesis, it was titled that because this stripper character goes through an anoesis experience, not gnosis, anoesis. Anoesis means the sensual. Okay. Here, let's pull it up here. Dictionary.com. Yeah. Okay. Anoesis, a state of mind consisting of pure sensation or emotion without cognitive content. That's Chokhmah consciousness, folks, that I was writing about 6-7 years ago. Okay. All right. So anoesis is the actual antithesis to gnosis, to Gnosticism itself. All right. I mean, I have all kinds of problems with Gnosticism, but one of the big problems of Gnosticism is that it is the anti sun and steel. It is the anti Mishima-san. It is the anti mysticism of the flesh. It is effectively saying two things. One is the flesh is bad, which if you read Mishima-san brilliantly, I think describes that it's not, as does Kabbalah, but that's besides the point. Okay. And that you can only achieve ascension after you die. That's also wrong. Okay. A, the idea that you have to die is wrong. B, the idea that ascension can only happen at death is also wrong. Okay. So anoesis is what it's all about. Mishima-san in Sun and Steel does a fantastic job of accurately explaining how language is effectively a prison. It imprisons you and it tricks you into a false sense of power, right? The lack of power of the body. The power that can truly take on and take in and, the sensual, that can take in the universe around you, that can truly feel it and experience it. Now, it's not just that short story, Anoesis, where I've talked about this. You can read even up to, you know, recent newsletter issues of the new newsletter. You can even read in there where so many times it, when I'm talking about sex and talking about the orgasm, it's always about getting to this place where words no longer exist. And that's, yes, I was inspired by Kabbalah, but I was absolutely inspired by Mishima-san with Sun and Steel. And I would argue that's the state, not that you necessarily want to stay in that state, because the reason I say this, you don't want to stay in Hokma consciousness, but then you don't want to deny it either. But, you know, you appreciate Hokma consciousness by coming back to Bina consciousness and being able to integrate what you experienced in Hokma. Like it's not sweet and sour, because that's inferring one is bad and one is good. That's not true. Okay. It's just, you can't, you know, kind of like we talked about with understanding the nature of superorganism that is universe. You can't really know unless you're getting some kind of information from outside of it. Bina consciousness is something outside of Hokma consciousness and vice versa. So they color each other, and it's the only way that you can get to anything akin to a notion of truth, or at the very least personal truth and personal experience and reality, personal reality. Okay. So yeah, for Jacob to bring it up, Jacob, I love you, man. And I mean that, like, thank you for paying so much attention, because at 2 points in just this episode, we brought up how you have been listening for years and how you've recognized, no, wait a minute. Dr. Sovereign has been saying this forever. Now these guys are coming out with this stuff and talking about it. Yeah. Well, that gets into a whole other conversation. But the one thing, you know, and I guess if I were to put it in brief, because if anyone's inspired to go actually read Sun and Steel, and I do recommend doing it because he does a fantastic job of describing this mysticism of the flesh. If I were to very briefly and simply explain what Mishima-san got wrong, is that it doesn't have to, you know, his idea that the body will decay and that, yeah, you can achieve this peak, this pinnacle of musculature and ability of your body, and then it just goes downhill, and you can either die the glorious death, which, by the way, I think Zack Snyder was also extremely influenced by Mishima-san. I could see it in his work as well, where, you know, I mean, even in Man of Steel, right, where the Kryptonians are always saying, good death is its own reward. Like that's straight up out of Yukio Mishima's work. Probably why I love those movies as well, because I can see the same philosophy that inspired me. Even though, again, the good death is not its own reward. Okay. The glorious death is not its own aim. And this is what Mishima got wrong. It's not about, and in fact, what's so amazing is I think Zack Snyder got this as well, because that's in the same fucking movie, right? So the Kryptonians that, you know, under General Zod, they're saying a good death is its own is its own reward. But then the quote unquote hero, or the good Kryptonians, that being, you know, Superman and his father, Jor-El, what's Jor-El's response to death? His response is to, of course, you know, send his, like, no, promote life and send his son off to, you know, a faraway planet. But what is his instruction to his son? What is it? What does he tell his son? What are you to do? Direct quote from the film. You're only going to know how powerful you are if you keep pushing the limits. And that's what Mishima-san got wrong, was that, and this is the short version of why he's wrong. Okay. Death is not what you have to accept. What you can do is keep pushing the limits. Your body doesn't have to give out. You know, I'm blown away. Big fan of Jay Cutler, bodybuilder. Okay. Arguably one of, if not the greatest Mr. Olympia of all time. I've argued sometimes that he is the greatest Mr. Olympia, not because of how many Olympias he won, but because he's the only one that I know of that lost a year and then came back and won the following. Like he had a genuine comeback, and it was a brilliant one. Just dynamite. I had the pleasure of getting to meet him. You know, this is not a surprise that I'm a fan of Jay Cutler. I have a signed hat from him. I'm a big fan. I even have a little poster of him anyway, that he also signed, which was, you know, very gracious of him. Anyway, so Jay Cutler, he's 50 years old now. He just recently turned 50. And while, yes, I'm sure there are a lot of gear, there's a lot of gear or drugs, as some would call it, in use at this time, but he looks, you know, he's done a real push lately. He was calling it Fit for 50. He looks incredible. And he even came out and said, and I know a lot of people say this, but again, he's got the body to back it up, and the button within the body is truth. That's one of Mishima-san's points. Okay. Forget the language. Language is trapping you. Get away from language. Well, I mean, language can be useful. He even talks about that, but watch the Esoterica video on that. Anyway, back to Jay Cutler. Jay Cutler came right out and said, he was doing an interview with Michael Hearn, who's another example of this. Drugs or not, whatever. Okay. He said that the way he feels right now, he feels like he could just do it all over again. And again, he has the fucking receipts because he looks incredible. When what he meant by he could do it all over again right now was he feels better than he did at 18. He doesn't have joint pain. He doesn't have all these other problems that he had when he was 18, when he had less knowledge. Okay. But he has the knowledge. He has learned the language of his body so well that at 50 fucking years old, he's in better shape, better condition, healthier than he was when he was in hell, even prime or pre-prime. And I believe him. And again, he's got the receipt. Just look at him. Okay. And you can say, oh, but he's doing steroids. He's doing this. Hold on. Back up. Okay. So without steroids, we can't get that big, but that doesn't mean we can't get dang near. And we can, and people can. Okay. So, you know, this speaks to the point that what Jay Cutler did was he kept pushing the limits. And I remember when he said it a few years ago, he straight up said, he's like, yeah, he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to beat Father Time because no one else has done it. Fucking right, man. And he he knew what he needed to do. Push the limits. He's 50 years old, better shape than he was at 20. And he was winning. What, you think he was a slob at 20? No, is it a relative thing? By no means. He's taking championships at that age. So that's my point, is that what Mishima-san gets wrong is that you don't have to give into the inevitability, the quote unquote inevitability, because it's not inevitable, the inevitability of death. You can just keep pushing the limits. It's no guarantee that you're going to live forever, but it is an alternative to the long night that Mishima-san would talk about. So, and that's where it is for me. That's why, you know, as much as, boy, I disagree with Mishima-san, at the same time, I agree with him in so many ways. And he is so wonderfully succinct in describing the mysticism of the flesh and the language of the body. Perhaps the most important language. In fact, it's more of an anti-language, right? He's describing that Chokmah consciousness and that ability and everything that comes along with it. Oh, it's so beautiful. So just don't fall for the fascism shit. Okay. And if you need a chaser, all right, if you need a chaser after reading Sun and Steel, go listen to, was it Buffy St. Marie? Go listen to her song, Universal Soldier. That'll kick you out of any militaristic tendencies you might have. I wish I had it when I was younger. I mean, it did exist. I just didn't know it. Anyway, go do that and bring a box of tissues too. It'll make me cry. Anyway, so we're at almost 2 hours. I'm going to look at, I don't know if I exactly answered Jacob's question, but let's see. But seriously, to expand on that, I watched Paul Schrader's Mishima film last month and Justice Sledge released a video on Sun and Steel. Knowing your love of Japan, I'd be surprised if you didn't at least have some cursory knowledge of Mishima. I'm quite unfamiliar with him myself, but since I came across him, I figured I'd ask you if he's influenced your thinking in any way. Yeah, I think we laid it out, you know, where he did. And it was so many things that came together, right place, right time. I don't know if his message, and I have to admit, I don't know if his message would have resonated with me as much if I wasn't so into, you know, Star Wars. You know, and TIE Fighter. which talk about the biggest poster I've got. It's TIE Fighter. You know, and so I'm going to end this off. I want to wrap this up. In that I have a question for everyone, because here's the thing. You know, I don't know, like, I consider myself a Kabbalist. I always have. Okay. I don't know if espousing Kabbalah, you know, like Kabbalah proper, I worry sometimes that would turn people off. Like, should there be some other kind of term for this? You know, I don't know, not necessarily that I would go with mysticism of the flesh, but, you know, or maybe should it be mystic more general? You know, I like, this is something I'd love to hear from your thoughts on this, because part of the problem is when, you know, if I do say to somebody I'm a Kabbalist, they instantly think I believe in God. And so they don't get it. You know, so I could spend the rest of my life like re-educating people on what Kabbalah actually says, you know, or it's insinuating. But again, language is psychedelic, so you can sometimes read into it, sometimes even what you want. You know, I mean, that's the nature of much language as we experience, even in English. You know, sometimes I think about it as we're talking about like honing down terms. You know, maybe Kabbalah isn't the best thing to be pushing, even though we're ultimately pushing, or I'm ultimately pushing Kabbalah, or expressing it anyway as something that's valuable. Why is it valuable? Again, it promotes life. It is a genuine, it is actual actionable steps outside of the political system. You know, it is also that. I mean, but it's also the nature of the universe, or nature of universe. Sorry. So I wonder if different terms are needed, or something, you know, maybe there's something that has to be out there that expresses itself, that is a lot more clear, kind of like what we talked about by calling it universe, not the universe, capitalizing the U, so on. You know, folks, that's not anything new for me. I've done that like hell. You'll never see me type hell with a lowercase h. Okay. the internet, when I used to respect the internet, I always, you know, gave it a capitalized I. Now I don't do that anymore, because I don't respect it and I think it's dead. So, you know, I'm not gonna, there's no point. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. It's just the thought that I've had, and maybe there is some other kind of term or even broader, I don't want to say bigger tent, but more efficacious, more precise tent, that term that could be applied than Kabbalah. It's just something I think about. Feel free to, you know, let me know if you've got any ideas on that. But I'm going to wrap this up here. I think I gave you a whole hell of a lot to sink into, you know, because I mean, the other part is I don't want people to think, oh yeah, Kabbalah, so I got to be Jewish. No, you don't have to be Jewish. Okay. Yes, I am. You don't have to be. And you know, as Arthur Green, Rabbi Arthur Green, well, I don't know if he wants to be called that, but anyway, you know, one of the great Jewish scholars, Arthur Green, as he has even recently said, you know, is Judaism the only way? No, but it's our way, speaking for himself. So, you know, there are other ways. Anyway, just something to think about, little question for you. How about that? And I will end this here, and I'll see all of you, woo, on the other side.